Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea. This is the Cuckoo's Nest Broadcasting System presenting the Jerry Roach Show. And good morning, Tokyo. Well, today we're sitting here with two Los Angeles mainstays, pioneers of punk rock, Geza X and Don Bowles.
Thanks.
Don played the Cuckoo's Nest many times with 45 Grave, but he's probably more famous for being the drummer for the legendary Germs. What do you want to play, Don?
Well, I think the first thing that I was thinking about playing was that fabulous and underheard, because the only place you can hear it, I think, is in that movie, right? Rage. I'm kind of a little embarrassed by that movie. So I did have the great luck to be in it, you know. But the song that Jack Grisham wrote for it, and I think Geza X produced it actually.
Did you produce that?
Yeah,
Geza X here in the studio with us.
It's the title track from the non-existent soundtrack to the movie Rage. Seemingly an infinity of boredom, having something to do with punk rock.
Well, we've never done a
show. Oh, wait, it was called something else, right? 25 years.
We've never done a show without Jack Grisham. And so here he is singing
Spit out that rage.
Jack and Grisham.
It's one of my favorite things that Jack ever did musically that I know of.
Okay, here it is.
Just give me a beer. Hey, Mom, did you take my bong? Just give me some rope. You know it won't take long. Politics, no politics. Just lay me here fucked up in the sand. Spit out the rage.
minutes.
But anyway, the reason, the way that movie came to be is Mike Bishop and I were talking, and we decided it'd be a good idea to take that old movie of mine and update it and use the old footage. And so we made an agreement, and as soon as that happened,
Was that the Clockwork Orange County one, or which one? Which movie? No,
this was Urban Struggle.
Urban Struggle. And then what was the next one? Was the other one?
We made a movie 30 years later called We Were Feared, mm-hmm, as a working title, and that became a Clockwork Orange County.
And is that the one with them young and older?
Yeah,
is that the one?
Yeah, the Clockwork Orange County is the modern
really interesting
one.
Project.
Which
dude.
I wanted
That's
to do.
So good history.
Which I wanted to do with Mike Bishop then, mm-hmm, and then we had a problem. I says, okay, you can't use any of my stuff. So he just used the last part, that the best part of the movie, where they just showed flashes of the photographs, uh-huh, which were Ed Culver's photos and Glenn Friedman's.
Yeah.
But it was me who
composed it. I understand.
Yeah. Edited it and made
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no. It's
by that time, most people had either fallen asleep or left the theater.
Yeah, but an embarrassing thing was Jack told me that they showed it in Santa Barbara, and he was there.
Jack
the showing.
Jack Grisham was there for the show.
And he got up in front of all the people and said, I just want all you people to know that I had nothing to do with this movie. Just completely disavowed anything
good.
To do with it at all. And that was his part,
Unfortunately, I had a lot to do with it because he really didn't have a lot of people around. So he had me in the studio trying to help with the music and stuff. And that's how that soundtrack, that title song, happened,
I've got a good Jack Grisham story.
Oh, yeah? What?
Well, it's the only one. Like, we didn't really hang out that much because he was down in Orange County all the time and we were up in L.A. all the time. But we'd run into him occasionally. We were friendly, the 45 Grave folks and the TSOL crowd. And one time he was playing a show at, I think it was Irvine. It was an outdoor show. And TSOL played, and then Jack, I guess he was on acid, and he had jumped into the crowd at one point and knocked this girl out, and she got taken to the infirmary, and he was like freaking out because he was on acid and he was really worried about it, and she hadn't come back by the end of the set, and he comes off stage and he's kind of seemed really worried and such. And Paul Cutler thought it'd be funny to tell him that the girl had died.
Oh, God.
And so he's like, tell him she's just dead. I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. He's like giggling like a lunatic. Because Paul was an evil genius. And evil genius. And so I was like, Jack, dude, I think you killed her, man. We're going to have to get you out of here. What? I couldn't really take it anymore. So I think we finally told him. But I guess it was one of those, boy, if you could have seen the look on his face.
Oh, yeah. I can just imagine it.
I guess he had, to be fair, he was always nice to me. He never did anything mean or rotten to me, but I have been given to understand by Jack himself, actually, that he was not the nicest person to everybody.
Well, yeah, he's legendary. He wrote a book about it in detail. So Geza X and the Mommy Men played the Cuckoo's Nest, and Geza is one of the pioneers of audio, and I remember him having a little like a TV mic that you were singing through, which gave a really interesting. I'll never forget it. I was really impressed by it.
It was kind of tinny sounding, but what it was I wanted to get away from a mic stand, because I liked running around the stage all manically. And so I had my guitar cord all strapped up to my belt, and I had a guitar strap that wasn't even a strap. It would hook to my belt, and so I could flop the guitar around. And so I got a headset, but it was a sports announcer's headset. It didn't have very good fidelity, and I modified it. I took all the earphone part and all that other stuff off, and I just made it so I could just push it down into my hair. And then here came this little microphone out the front, And it sounded really boxy and cheesy, but I didn't care because it was like I was almost free. But I had to have wires, you know, from the guitar and from that because nothing was wireless in those days. So by the end of the set, I'd be spinning around like a dervish and I would like look at the wires and they'd be all tangled and knotted together and it would get shorter and shorter as the set would progress. Apparently, I always turned in the same direction.
Your tether got tighter.
But I'm listed in Wikipedia. I mean, that's, you know, my one of little claim to fame was that I actually did pioneer the headset microphone.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, good. Mm-hmm. Good. Wow. Some credit.
You know, I'm not listed in Wikipedia. However, the Don Bowles that I took his name, when he wasn't using it anymore.
You
he was a reporter
story,
who
yeah.
was killed in Phoenix, Arizona in 1976 by like the mafia or something who he was investigating. And he was, there's a big plaque in the LA Press Club for Don Bowles because he was one of the first reporters killed by the mob for any reason. And it was like a big deal. And it was the biggest case in Arizona. And so it went on for, he worked for both the newspapers in Phoenix. And you couldn't turn on the TV or go to a Denny's and you know, sit next to people without hearing Don Bowles, Don Bowles, Don Bowles, read the paper, Don Bowles. Everywhere. And so I had a punk band I was starting at the time. I was trying to be in the Consumers because their bass player had gotten in a bicycle wreck and was in the hospital. And I had just started playing bass. And I played a couple practices with them, but I was so terrible. The third practice, they hid from me. You know, and I knocked at the door and I got the message. And I started my own punk band and where I was going to play bass. But I had to get my friend who was a guitar player to play drums and my friend who was a drummer to play guitar. So they'd be on my level. And so we started a band. And
good strategy.
Yeah, well, it worked. We were all about the same skill level. And
Perfect for punk.
Yeah, it worked really well for us. But yeah, anyway. God, what the hell was I talking about?
Don Bowles.
Oh, yeah, of course. There he was. And so the Consumers were like, they were good. These guys had like 50 great songs.
Yeah,
we had three, you know, songs that weren't very good. They were okay. Just like your mom, Vox Pop was one of them. But the Consumers were all musicians from bands
good
like
players.
Elijah, like you were talking about.
Yeah, they great
were like Paul Cutler was in horn bands as the guitar player. You know, he was an amazing rock guitarist and a classically trained pianist. But so they were really ass kicking. They practiced all the time. Were amazing. Our band, we couldn't play at all. But we were the only two games in town for punk rock. And finally, the hippie station got wind.
This was in Phoenix, right?
Yeah, got wind of punk rock in Phoenix, Arizona. And this is 1977. And they called and I answered them like, hello, and hello. This is so-and-so Bob Knob or something from KDKV. And we wanted to talk to you about your punk rock band. You know, what's the name of your punk rock group? What's your name, sir? And I said, Don Bowles. And they're like, Don Bowles? any relation? No, just a coincidence. And that's so strange. Yeah, I know, it's weird, huh? He goes, and what's the name of your punk rock group? And I forgot to mention that Don Bowles got his legs blown off in his car when he turned the ignition on, and that's how he died a few days later.
Wow.
But yeah, and so he says, "What's the name of your punk rock group, Mr. Bowles?" And I said, "The Bloody Stumps."
Oh, okay. Good one.
Yeah, and we didn't keep that name. I think we kept the name for a few minutes.
Great,
you know, but
name.
Yeah, but anyway, that's you know.
So you had him.
And so anyway.
He knows he's been had.
Yeah. But I kept the name when I moved to L.A. just because if anybody knows this name, they're probably from Phoenix and they're probably someone I would know. It was like something from home, you know.
By the way, you are on Wikipedia.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that's really weird. But I wasn't for the longest time. And there's a Don Bowles listing, but it's this other Don Bowles and it's my picture.
That might be what you're referring to.
Yeah.
Don Bowles from the Germs or punk rock Don Bowles. It's like
they catch up. Wikipedia, they're always revising it.
The number
endlessly.
One is your story about the reporter, but it's on the same page as your second, you know. Like,
oh, good, good. So. Yeah, but someone said
it's
that
the
there
same
was,
page?
Oh, yeah. Like,
yeah, someone said
page.
That there was his story in my picture.
Well, no, you just Don Bowles says Don Bowles, and then you realize it goes Don Bowles from the punk rock band. So it's like
see the germs or something.
Yeah,
and it should say disambiguation. Right there. You don't have to, sometimes it says disambiguation. That'd be perfect.
Disambiguation. Isn't that a punk band? Aren't they on Burger Records?
I've never heard that word. What, disambiguation?
Disambiguation.
There's a word that they use a lot in, if they can't like hook up all the pieces to a story, I think they say disambiguation somewhere in the text.
Ambiguous.
They want it to be less ambiguous.
Interesting.
Disambiguation needed, maybe it says.
It sounds like super. You know how they do that.
Disambiguation.
Yeah, good song.
You got it.
Prejudicious. Yeah, so, it's a good word.
Anyway, we were reminiscing about the old days, and I guess it came up about it wasn't easy to be a punk rocker in some circles. You guys were kind of safe in Hollywood. They expect weirdos.
Not really. In Phoenix, we weren't.
Hollywood wasn't safe.
Yeah, but most of my punk rockhood was spent in Phoenix.
In those days, that it was like so shocking, and it was like also, despite the fact that the record company said there was no commercial potential, actually it was on the front page of every newspaper and magazine, especially music magazines, for like 2 years. And so and fashion magazines really picked up on punk really, really a lot in the
mid-70s.
Madonna,
I think, had something. Remember when she came out dressed up like a punk rocker and doing the Madonna thing?
Yeah, sure. Well, they had already lifted that stuff from Exene, and, you know, a lot of those women did.
She took it to the big market.
But Exene and Debbie Harry, you know, they really trailblazed a few things about a female look.
Susie and the Banshees.
Susie, of course, yeah.
And, you know, she wore swastikas all the time. So did Sid Vicious. Giant swastika T-shirt. That sure was to die for. And
oh, you're pouting.
That's so funny. Remember that? And remember
Don
Johnny Rotten has that destroy thing with the huge swastika? You can still get those ones. But,
oh, yeah.
But back then, you know, there...
Why don't you tell them you're just a collector?
No, but it's so weird to me. The very idea of a Nazi punk just seemed so abstract and bizarre. Like, no, how can that be? Nazi punks, fuck off. What are you talking about? Only in San Francisco. And then I found out later he wasn't kidding. There really were these people.
Nazi punks?
Yeah. And
well,
I was
it
like,
got
whoa.
Like that, you know, but that was later
it
on.
It did. But that was when that single came out, was later on, too.
I know.
But yeah,
I recorded it.
That was post. You recorded that one?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I recorded so much of the Dead Kennedy stuff.
Oh, yeah. And you did Holiday in Cambodia.
I did Holiday in Cambodia.
He played the Cuckoo's Nest right after he ran for mayor, shortly after his. What did he come
that
in?
That was wicked funny, him running for mayor. But we got the real story in the movie that he didn't do any of the work. Apparently, it was Dirk Dirksen from the Mabuhay who had, like, you know, done all of that stuff to promote it.
He got all the papers involved.
This is when Jello Biafra ran for mayor of San Francisco and got like something like 8% of the vote or something crazy
like
that.
Yeah, he was like third or fourth.
Anyways, apparently they say he was a slob and he slept until like, you know, 6 p.m. and just barely made it to sign the papers.
Well, you know, when Jack ran for governor, I right away said, oh, we'll have some fun with this, Jack. Let me be your campaign manager. I was just thinking, why, your brain can go free with stunts you can pull and just promote the, I mean, you know, and he takes it seriously. But Jack, you know, don't be serious about this. It's like there's no way you're going to get elected. So why be serious? Just use it
just
as
have
a
fun,
bloody
yeah.
pulpit, you know.
Yeah.
Or something like that. What
a bloody stump.
A bully pulpit.
A bloody stump.
A bully pulpit.
Bully pulpit. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
Correct.
Bully
That's the correct term.
A bloody pulpit. That with Jacket, it'd probably be a lot closer to a bloody
really
pulpit when he was
me,
done with it.
You know, and he still gives me shit about it.
Well, we love Jack, you know, but he was such a reprobate back then.
Anyway.
He's like a real sweetheart, man.
Oh, he's a
what
doll.
Happened?
And he's so clever though. And so funny. He's such a good storyteller.
Yeah, he's still funny.
We got to have him back on
stories.
The show. That...
He's not like these people that like turn all nice and then they have no sense of humor anymore.
No, you know,
we're still talking
him being
about
off drugs, his brain just gets going so fast that he comes up with a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah, his well, brain does go fast.
That was
he's
probably
smart.
A lot of his problem to begin with.
Never
you know?
A dull for sure. Moment, you know,
a lot of the punks, that's their problem. They were just so smart. They already knew everything in school, and they were just like, next thing to learn, please. And that was when the schools were just so declining.
And they started putting – a lot of these South Bay kids, they all came up – they were on Ritalin. It's like, you know, I was like so surprised how common it was, you know, that they all had ADD and they all are on Ritalin. Yeah. No wonder they're acting like weird, you know.
Yeah, it's crazy how that
gave
works.
It away like candy.
Yeah. That was the era when it really started to become like that.
Yeah, I know they had my son on it, and so I started trying it. And
but that's different when you're a grown-up.
Yeah, so I like driving home in the Laguna Canyon, and we get one of those pullover, and I pull over and we have a fight with this guy. He blindsides me, and then we end up fighting. And we're right in this traffic at Laguna Canyon there where El Toro comes in.
Whoa.
And so then, you know, I go to the police department. Like, I'm selling real estate. I'm dressed up, you know. And so I turn the guy in. I mean, blindsided him. Of course, I pulled over, but, you know, I kind of backed him down, and then he turned away, and I turned away, and then he let me have it. So we, you know, I kind of got the best of him, but just for good taste, just for covering my ass, I reported it, you know. And then about a week later, I'm walking my dog, and it was just a puppy, a collie, and it was a girl, and it was a puppy. And we're walking along, and this guy's Cocker Spaniel attacks my collie. Well, the collie's a little bigger, but it's a puppy, right? This dog's chasing my collie around circles, you know, so I just kind of kick the Cocker Spaniel away. And this guy starts hitting me with his broom. Starts hitting me with his broom. And I go, oh, this is going to be fun. And I'm going, I'm not a dog. I am a human being. I'm setting it up. You're hitting me. Wow. And then his son comes, and I let him have it. And so the police are called, and then they go, wait a minute. Didn't you get in a fight a week ago? And I'm going, maybe I better quit taking Ritalin. But I don't know if the Ritalin had anything to do with it.
Ritalin's speed, basically.
Well,
speed never made me want to fight.
Yeah. I was growing up.
I think maybe
I'm
so.
Over 40.
I think maybe so.
But I would have done the same thing with a dog thing. And I don't know about pulling over. That's kind of crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Road rage is a little
we
much. Speaking
that.
Of rage.
Yeah, so much. I love real estate.
I had two things to, one thing actually to say to Mike Bishop after seeing that movie. And it was like the premiere up at Laurel Canyon.
We're talking about
Sunset.
Rage.
Yeah,
the
once
punk
again.
Rock movie.
Yeah.
I was in it. I saw that premiere.
I told him, man, you know, you got to go back and fix this thing. And I go, you can't release it like that. It, you know what it needs? And he goes, what's that? And I go, more punk, less junk.
He used all, I told some great stories, and then like he used this one little piece that like was totally irrelevant to anything. And I was just like, why did I even bother? You know,
he edited mine to where like it made less sense than when I even said it.
I hope that's not what we're
and
what,
and there was
do.
That long there was that long interview with Keith Morris where he has these funny glasses on.
Oh yeah,
like I don't want to be part of this, so
right.
I'm gonna wear these glasses.
And he had a wig on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was still Keith Morris. I thought that was funny, but weird. I didn't
it was
like
all right,
that.
But
it didn't like.
To me, it looked
it still
like
made
he
it
doesn't want
that.
Keith Morris to be in it, so he's just going to put the wig on, the hair, and.
It looked like Keith Morris didn't want Keith Morris to be in it.
That's what it was. But
it went on and on,
it
too,
it
and
all.
It seemed to be boring, too, whatever he was talking about. I mean, all of it was boring. And he betrayed Jack by just leaving the damn thing running and don't edit it. It's just like, okay. And then Jack just goes on and on and on and on and on. Until
he did that.
He kind of runs out of shit finally, you know, and he kind of let him barbecue himself, really. It was, you know
Jack
what I mean?
Jack still came off good in it.
Yeah, but
Jack came off best of everyone in there.
He always does, but they like, could have edited a little bit and not hung him out to dry, kind of like, you know what I mean? It's just like he kept
exactly.
him going.
I hear you. That's
with no editing for 12 minutes or something, you know, and it's
That's right. We're trying to go the exact opposite route, which is like, you know, to
we're
kind
gonna try
of
and
like,
get a sound bite out of a thing, you know.
Yeah, and to really show like kind of like the what was great about everybody and why they all ended up kind of becoming who they are, and also why everybody kind of got along and, you know, how they enjoyed each other's company. There was like a lot of, you know, friendship and conviviality going on, you know, with behind all of this sort of faux fighting and breaking
shit. There were some
shit.
Frenemies, but you know. Yeah.
You know, I remember the dawn of hippies, and I remember this feeling that we had kind of as kind of like our thing, and that happened with the punks, the same thing with it in the beginning. It was like our deal. And that was the same thing in the beginning of the hippies.
I experienced that too,
our deal. We all smoke pot, we all like this music, and we're taking LSD, and it's our little thing, you know, and it spread around the world.
It was hard to be a hippie, too, until it got really big.
Yeah, they went through the same, you know, persecutions. And
I had to go through it a few times.
And there were a lot of people like myself that didn't go all the way, but we were kind of like sympathizers. Maybe you would have called me a new wave guy. I mean, I'm there, but I'm not going to shave my head because I'm going to college and I'm going to get a job.
Yeah.
I don't totally, you know, and I'm not a musician, so I don't completely buy into it. I mean,
I
buy into the
hair,
concept,
then.
But so I was a sympathizer, and I grew my hair long, and I smoked pot, and I had a hell of a lot of fun.
You were one of those commie sympathizers they were always talking about.
Actually, yeah, I was anti-Vietnam.
I used to hear that a lot in the 60s.
I was anti-Vietnam.
Yeah.
Oh, who was?
I was really active. I was doing draft counseling when I was like 14 and printing flyers at UCLA and Berkeley. I was at the Berkeley People's Park riots.
Oh,
I was
really?
Really
that
deeply
was legendary.
Involved in the 60s. Yeah.
That story of the People's Park is...
I spoke in front of that crowd.
Were you there and watched it evolve? Like how everyone.
Yeah, I was there for weeks.
One guy's lily pond became another guy's. I mean, it just
kind of.
It's kind of
a beautiful story, really, because it was just a. You know, there was the People's Park story from the 60s basically went like this. There was like, you know, like hippies, and they were like, you know, they were looking for places to like, you know, throw their. Events and things like that. And they also were trying to, you know, find places, you know, for gardening and all kinds of like, you know, back to nature types of stuff. And so what happened was surprisingly, BART, before it was ever built, they had already annexed a whole bunch of land. And so they gave us a plot of land and said, just plant your shit here. And so like what happened was suddenly this park, I mean, I was shoveling shit out of the, you know, horse shit out of the back of a truck as fertilizer onto the ground there. And then like, you know, within a week, all of this stuff sprang up. And then what happened was a few weeks later, we were betrayed and in came all of the cops and the tanks
but didn't
and all this stuff.
It only lasted a couple of weeks?
No, it lasted a really long time, but there was fighting for it for the longest time.
Right.
It was a long going battle.
Right, but...
Oh, no, there was an original People's Park, and then I think that everybody
Berkeley.
Got kicked out.
In Berkeley.
And then BART gave... some space to shut everybody up, and that lasted longer. I think that's how
I
it
see.
Went.
Yeah. Because I remember somehow riding a long distance in a car with a kid that was coming from People's Park, and somehow, maybe we were hitchhiking, I don't know, somehow we wound up in the same car, and he was telling the story of People's Park and how he was there and how all the way down until they evicted him and what a...
Might have been me.
No.
That's funny, though. That's great. Yeah,
and,
yeah that
so
was
I,
one of the
I,
big
that was
stories
a pivotal,
from the 60s.
Event in the 60s that probably people don't realize, but that was I remember it well. You know, I was a character in a novel by James Michener. Actually, myself and another guy were the inspiration for this book called The Drifters, and my character was a draft dodger. You know, and Michener. Was going to do a short story about me and this other California guy who was from another generation and how we fought about Vietnam. And anyway, it turned into a whole book called The Drifters. And my character was the draft dodger. And I remember Mitchell, when he interviewed me, asked me how to beat the draft. And I gave him every way I ever thought of, you know, and every one of them is in the book. Anyway, it's kind of a long story because I thought I was going to be in Iberia, which he told me was going to be a short story in his book, Iberia. It wasn't in there. And I thought, oh, well, that end of that. And years later, a friend of mine goes, you know that story, I think it's in this book. And I read it word for word, everything I said is right.
Is that how writers do character research?
Well,
that's so
did,
interesting.
The way he
yeah.
did it, you know, he spent like 3 hours and four or five beers, you know, and wrote down, took notes. And I guess that, we became a whole book. I'm Joe from The Drifters.
Hey, Joe.
That's my...
Where are you going with that gun in your hand?
One of my claims to the fame that I don't really talk about because...
That's
another
cool.
long story. I told a kid that one time, and he got really pissed off. He thought I was making it up, you know, because this Joe guy was his hero.
And he didn't like you?
I'm like, you know, this is 30 years later, you know, and I, off the cuff, I wasn't very serious about it, and he thought I was making it up, and he got mad at me. So ever since then, I was kind of sensitive about it. You know, I never really talk about it. But
that's a cool story.
But it is a fact.
You got interviewed, and that became the character.
Yeah. It was a guy named Harvey Holt was the other character. A guy named Matt Carney. He was another Pamplona guy. He runs the Bulls. You know, that's one of my deals. I go to Pamplona and run the Bulls. Ever since 1963, I've been going off and on.
To where?
Pamplona, Spain, to run the Bulls. When, you know, with
that's what I thought you said, but I'm just like, wait, you didn't really say that.
I used to say that's how I relax after running a punk rock joint.
That's funny. You got such a you know, rich and detailed history before and after Jeez. Punk rock that it was like really great getting your story of like
no
the
wonder we're having
Nest
him
days.
In the documentary.
Yeah.
This guy's amazing. Yeah, I can do one
more,
on him.
I gave you more than in my movie. The guys that made my latest movie, they get me like 11 in the morning. I just woke up and I'm kind of grumpy and that's my bit in the movie, you know. Terrible.
We really tried to go and make everybody comfortable because it's just really just the two of us and we're not filmmakers. We're just trying to catch the story of like kind of what happened with all of our friends.
Yeah. We're only filmmakers now because we're making a film.
Well, basically.
Yeah. Otherwise
and so,
not.
You know, so we've made it really a point to kind of get people, you know, to try to, you know, gain enough trust so that people are actually telling the real stories of what was going on with them and to, you know, like to say it in a manner that really reveals something about the culture of the time. It is an interesting story simply because it's gone through, morphed through so many different generations and it keeps reinventing itself somehow as punk rock.
Yeah, the people that make some of the Germs t-shirts told me that every generation of 15-year-olds rediscovers the Germs.
Hmm, yeah.
Well, I believe that, for sure.
It's like and your audience stays with you, too, but they don't forget you, you know.
No.
It's amazing how it grows. Oh, I was thinking we haven't been playing any songs. What do you want to play?
Well, you could play one from...
Would you mention that one? Yeah.
From my new band. It's, well, new. It's been
Nubian band?
Yeah, my Nubian band. There have been a Nubian or two through that band, so to speak. But it's called Fancy Space People.
Great band.
And yeah, we bring messages from our brothers and sisters or whatever they are from Fancy Space. And it's a why they picked Nora and I to do this band, but these Fancy Space aliens that are our leaders just thought we would fit well into their plans and into these weird costumes that they had already. And we were the right size for the suits. So we get to do the songs, you know, that they come up with the songs. They have some formula that they think is going to get their message, you know, across to the people of Earth. And it doesn't seem to be the most benevolent message in the universe either, to tell you the truth.
How do they operate your
bodies?
Although
it seems very nice. It's very politely phrased. But as far as I can tell, this song, it's called Fancy Space People, is basically them suggesting that perhaps the human race should be wiped out.
No.
Yeah, in order to save the ecosystems of the Earth and the universe from their malevolence or something. I don't know, but we just sing them. We just
produced this.
We just sing them. No, not this one.
He produced
this. That was something else.
He wouldn't have anything to do with
that. That was something else. No, I produced. Actually, he could have done it, except I did it. And we had some help from Kerry Brown, who produced all those Smashing Pumpkins albums and stuff.
Yeah,
he's got this Neve console in his studio. It's
beautiful,
like
studio.
Crazy $200,000 console. It's like we had recorded a lot of the stuff in this Fancy Space People theme that we're going to hear. At different places, it's all analog, pretty much. A couple of digital things in there, but I'm not going to say which. And Billy Corgan actually plays guitar on one tiny little section of it. He came up with a line while we were mixing it. Goes, oh my God, I got the perfect thing for this part. Do you mind if I get a guitar and go, dang, dang, dang? And I'm like, I don't care. You're like really famous. You know, your name's going to be on our record if you do that, and it's going to be great, right? You know, yeah, play the fuck out of it. And he did. He played this little guitar part. It was real cute. So you can sort of hear it in there. But anyway, so on this song, Fancy Space People, we did it over at Kerry Brown Studios. And through that Neve console, everything just sounds so much better. So we added a couple of things there, but mostly it was recorded other places and mixed over there. But
let's play it.
Yeah, I'm playing all the stuff on it. I play.
Oh, cool.
I play the drums. I don't play the bass on it. Jeff Brandon plays bass. And then I play all the guitars on it, except the one guitar part that Billy does, which is pretty good, I think. And I played synth on it, and I do a lot of the singing. And Nora Keys does the girl voice.
Before you play the song, I got to know one thing. How do they operate your bodies?
Well, they just, it's kind of chill, you know? I mean,
It's fine. It's like, they caught us at a really good time.
So there's just kind of an implicit.
There's an understanding. It's sort of, it's not even as hectic as a timeshare. It's fine. You know, it's like having an app, you know, that sort of has you. But it's kind of cool. They're very intelligent and they're fun to chat with, you know, although it looks really funny because nobody else can hear them, apparently, as I've found out a few times, much to my chagrin. But that,
let's hear the song.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's called Fancy Space People. I think Professor Cantaloupe and I did that middle part too. So, I mean, the whole thing is pretty much, we were under the hypnotic, spell of the Fancy Space People, who are our leaders. So, hence the name.
Here it is.
They came in diamond rows to stop the human foes from running the cherished star. Earth is the cherished star. The children for sight to fight the parasite and color up the gray with matching golden rays.
Oh,
Okay, we're back. And what we were talking about doing when that Geza produced and you played on, what was it?
Oh, yeah, that was No God by the Germs. I had already moved out here to L.A. I told the Germs that I was going to be their drummer on the telephone from Phoenix, Arizona. And they said, okay, sure. And then Darby proceeded to tell me about every ridiculous and hilarious sexual indiscretion of all these different people that I had never met and never even heard of that were L.A. punk people. And Pat and I talked about, I asked him if he was into krautrock and like, you know, all this stuff. And he's like, no. And he'd never heard any of these bands that I liked. And then, except like when it got to like Roxy Music and Bowie, you know, he was really into those. And Yes, he really liked Yes and Queen. And I was like, really? Are you kidding me? And, you know, because I had heard their forming single. I didn't hear a lot of Yes and Queen.
No, and, I know.
You know, that I heard. Well, I did hear a Queen, but I didn't really know at the time. But yet, you know, everyone always thought Pat was gay, and he's like straight as an arrow, and always had a really amazing girlfriend.
Always.
You know, and or two or three sometimes, and now he's got an amazing wife and a kid. But yeah, it was always Darby that was gay. But nobody ever knew that he was gay. You didn't even know he was gay.
No, I didn't.
Well, I like to say he wasn't gay. He was homosexual. Yeah. Big difference. Gay people like old movies and Barbara Streisand and Judy Garland and stuff. And homosexuals like to have sex with little skater boys.
Exactly.
But or Darby did anyway. He liked that. And you know, who can blame? You got to like what you like and do what you do. But anyway, so I moved here to join the Germs because it was like the most enigmatic thing I'd ever encountered, especially after these phone conversations and hearing that forming single and the B-side especially. It was like, what?
Almost unlistenable.
It made no sense to me at all, and I loved that. So, you know, I was like, so
you art rocker.
I was I had to go where sense didn't exist as best I could. And so I moved to LA. Went to see him at the Elks Lodge. All these other bands asked me to join their band instead and said the Germs sucked and were terrible and they were never going anywhere, and their band had a label and management and all this stuff. I won't name any names like F Word in the Bags and stuff, but, you know, all these bands. And I was like, nope, I'm here to join. I'm sure your band's very good, but I'm just interested in playing with the Germs, you know, sorry. Because they knew I was a drummer and nobody had drummers.
Tell about your audition.
And Well, I auditioned for the band in the Mask bathroom, which is legendary.
It was
in the yeah. And because the boys' room was completely unusable.
No, nobody ever went
there. And, but there was like this space where a toilet once was and a stall that wasn't really complete anymore either, and there was like a hollow spot in the floor where the toilet had been ripped out, and there were some bricks missing around the big hole in the floor that went to the sewer, and there was like urine and water and whatever. Kim Valley, sorry, borrowed your word, you know, but there was all that stuff, like 3.5 inches of this crap in there. And I had to set up my sort of stolen drum set, a little Sonor kit that I bought from a guy in Phoenix but forgot to pay them.
No, wasn't that Nicky Beats drum set?
No.
Already?
That was mine.
Okay, I didn't know
and,
that.
And I set it up in the bathroom in this puddle of God knows what. and I started making a bunch of noise, and they just looked at each other, and Pat goes, could you play like a song or something? And I was like, oh, okay. And I had just gotten a drum lesson from Nicky Beat, just in case of such an eventuality. And I had just started playing drums like a couple of months before, so I could join this other band that was in Phoenix, the third punk band. They were called the Exterminators, but they didn't need a guy to sing or to play shitty bass or shitty guitar, which I'd already taken up. They needed a drummer. So I said, okay, I'll play drums. And I borrowed a drum set and I went over and I tried out and it was okay. And so I that's when I got the cojones to say, hey, I'm going to come out and join the Germs. I'm a drummer. So anyway,
great story.
But so I auditioned. I played. Nicky Beat had showed me how to play "Life of Crime" by the Weirdos, which was one of my favorite Weirdos songs, I think that was all he'd showed me at the time. And so I learned "Life of Crime." I go, I can play "Life of Crime" by the Weirdos, and Pat's going, great. That'd be great. Let's play something, you know. And I'm like, okay, and I played, you know, and I did "Life of Crime," and I guess it was suitably frantic, And they sort of deliberated, and they went outside, and excuse us a moment, they went outside and they talked amongst themselves, and Geza was outside there too, I found out later. And they were like, what do you think? I don't know, what do you think? What do you think? And then Geza chimed in. I know he's right here. He probably remembers this too. He told me about it. Said, well, he did come all the way from Phoenix.
To be in your band. Anybody who does that is going to be loyal.
Yeah. And they're like, huh. You know, that's true. And so then they came back in, and Darby goes, okay, you're a germ. And then
can I jump in about the single? Because the single, the way the single
then,
happened.
Yeah, so then I was already in the band, but Nicky Beat had been playing drums with the Germs as their fill-in drummer, although he couldn't join the band because the Weirdos wouldn't allow it. And he wanted to stick with the Weirdos because they were going to be huge. And the Germs were just, you know, no one was going to remember them in a year. So here's where you are.
So all of a sudden, Slash magazine decides to put out a Germs single, you know, and Slash was like the big shit at the time in Hollywood. And so I'd been spreading the word around the mask that I was a record producer. I didn't even know what a record producer did. I had had a brief stint at a recording studio called Artist Recording Studio right across literally the street from the mask where I had slept on the floor before I slept on the floor of the mask.
And you did sound at the mask, which was some cred, I guess.
That's true. And so I had had a small amount of experience engineering, you know, like just working the board and stuff like that. So I was, you know, pompously saying that I was a producer, and Darby slaps me on the shoulder one day. He goes, you a producer, produce the Germs. And I'm going like, what? And he goes, yeah, Slash is going to put our record out.
Yeah, you're a producer, like, produce us.
Yeah, that's right. You know? And I just said, okay. And it was like one of those $5 an hour studios, like under Hollywood Boulevard, like in a old deserted bank vault or something like that, you know, and we had like 5 hours total to record. I mean, it was a $25 session or something. That's how it went in those days.
Yeah, I remember. It's under the, I think it's a Scientology building now where that was.
The Germs were so nice. They were the most intelligent and curious kids, and that was before everything got all dark. So, like, they were just, like, you know, into it. And everything that was going on, everything that I did, everything that they came up with, everything that they talked about, it was just, like, on fire. They were so excited. It was really fun.
Yeah, those times are, you can't recapture them. That's for sure.
Yeah, but we can hear him. And then there was a...
Let's hear... I hate punk rock. I want to hear that.
Well,
one.
Wait. Let's hear the Germs single. Yeah. Let's hear No God, because Don Bowles is on that.
No God. And I play on this, but Nicky Beat played the drums. I didn't know the songs yet, although I was officially in the band. So,
yes, he was.
So I got to be on the record because I was hanging out. I had a great time. It was a great session. Geza thought Pat was going to bring an amp, and Pat thought Geza was going to bring an amp.
Yeah.
Neither of them brought an amp, and so or a distortion device or anything. And so Pat just had to plug straight into the mixing desk.
Through all my pedals, I brought a few pedals, so I made a weird sound for him, and that's the sound on that record.
It was like straight in. But anyway, so I'm just in here with everybody else. It was me and Pat Delaney from the Dead Beats, and I think Geza, were you in there too? And Pat and Lorna and Darby, right?
Yeah, we were all
non-deuce, 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 non-deuce. There you go. That's how it is.
All right, that's a good intro. Let's hear it. We'll be right back.
sure and tune in next week to the second part of Jerry's interview with Geza X and Don Bowles. We start fights with them punks at the cuckoo.